Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today we visit Bates College to join Maine conservation voters for a talk by Joel Clement. He was a climate scientist at the U.S. Department of the Interior until he resigned last year amid pushback from the Trump administration. Clement's talk is titled "The Trump Administration's War on Climate Policy: A View from a Whistleblower Who is Speaking Out." The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to hear this program again at your convenience and many other past Speaking in Maine programs. You can also find it as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Peggy Rotundo from the Howard Center for Community Partnerships at Bates College.
Good evening. I'm Peggy Rotundo from the Bates College Harwood Center for Community Partnerships, and I want to welcome you all to Bates College for a talk by Joel Clement entitled "The Trump Administration's War on Climate Policy, A View from a Whistleblower Who is Speaking Out." The college is pleased to be the convener of this important event in partnership with the Natural Resources Council of Maine, Maine Conservation Voters, and the Conservation Law Foundation. I want to thank our partners for their work in bringing Joel back to Maine and their efforts to make this evening possible. It's a great pleasure to welcome Joel Clement to Bates College. Joel is not a person you would expect to find in the middle of a national media firestorm, a place he's been since publishing a scathing op-ed in the Washington Post, which blew the whistle on the Trump administration's attempts to silence climate change scientists. As a Maine native and a forest biologist, he has been happiest in the quiet of the outdoors, particularly the woods of Maine. Joel graduated from the University of Virginia and then went on to the graduate program in forest biology at Evergreen State College in Washington State. With time, he became an expert in building resilience to climate change in the Arctic. After working on climate adaption for the Seattle-based conservation group Wilberforce Foundation, he joined the U.S. Interior Department in 2010, hoping to create needed policy change from within the federal government. As director of the U.S. Interior Department's Office of Policy Analysis, and as the department's leading expert on climate change, he worked with several Alaskan Native communities to help them plan for adaptation to rising sea levels. It was his speaking out about the dangers posed to these communities that led to his demotion within the Interior Department. Given that we're at Bates, the alma mater of Maine's Senator Edmund Muskie, whose legendary environmental work in the U.S. Senate culminated in the passage of the historic Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, we would do well to remind ourselves of some of the lessons he left with us. At the heart of Senator Muskie's pioneering environmental work lay the scientific expertise he worked so hard to acquire as a senator, and his ability to engage and learn from a variety of perspectives. Senator Muskie depended upon scientifically accurate information, as well as people willing to debate the merits of shared information. Thankfully, Joel Clement is writing another chapter in the legacy of Ed Muskie, insisting that integrity be brought to the policy arena, that policy be grounded in science and the free exchange of ideas, and that an abuse of power that fails to protect all American people who are in danger from the impacts of climate change be met with principled courage. We're honored, Joel, to have you here tonight.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Peggy, for that kind intro. And thanks to the organizers and the hosts for bringing me here. This is the first time I've spoken formally in my home state. So I'm tickled to be here. I've got family here. This is pretty exciting. So thanks again to the Conservation Law Foundation, to the Natural Resources Council of Maine, the Maine League of Conservation Voters, and, of course, the hosts here at Bates. I also want to pay my respects to Stephen Hawking. What a great scientific mind, a real gift to humanity, and how clever of him to die on Pi Day, right? I mean, also Albert Einstein's birthday. So in his honor, I'm going to state a scientific consensus. In this case, it's the scientific consensus on climate change, right? Rapid climate change is real, it's dangerous, and we're causing it. That's the scientific consensus. And now, this was stated unequivocally in the National Climate Assessment that was released remarkably and ironically by the Trump administration last year, the climate science chapter. So the multiple lines of evidence demonstrate that there is no other way to explain away this rapid change other than human activity. So that's what scientific consensus is. It's not something you believe in, like God or religion, right? It's what is. You don't have to believe in gravity, but if you trip, you're going to fall down, right? That's just how it works. And so now that I've established that, you know where I'm coming from on climate change. But I do want to say, despite the title even of the talk, that this is not going to be a partisan talk, right? I mean, clearly the Republican Party right now is stoking and promoting a lot of kind of indecency and falsehoods around issues like climate change, but also sexuality and gender and immigration and race and so on. I don't think we should pretend that both parties are doing that. I think the right wing, the far right wing, certainly has to own that. I think it's important to acknowledge that. But there still are some moderate Republicans out there, and Maine is home to a lot of them. So I don't want to tar them all with the same brush by taking a partisan tone here. So that's what I mean by that. I'm going to talk about science, and I'm going to talk about what I believe is important for American health and safety. But of course, as the title suggests, I'm going to excoriate the extremists in the Trump administration right now, right? And their enablers in Congress. And because they're bent on gutting the role of science and they're increasing the risk to American health and safety. So we can't let that slide. But my sense is that there are a lot of Republicans out there who would agree with me. And that's what I mean by this is not going to be a partisan talk. This is about the issues. And here in Maine, of course, you're seeing the very nonpartisan impacts of climate change already, and the future projections are quite frightening and also nonpartisan. The Gulf of Maine, as you all know, is warming faster than oceans around the world, and that's having an impact on fisheries. And I think by now everyone knows the lobster are moving north, but other things are moving north as well, and those darn black sea bass that eat the baby lobsters, we need to start eating them because that's going to have an effect on fisheries. Economic risk, nonpartisan. The lobster are not alone amongst Maine's icons that are threatened. The herring are moving north, so that means fewer puffins. Avian diseases are moving north, so that might mean fewer loons. Tick-borne diseases are moving north, fewer healthy moose. Right? Even the chickadees are moving north, and that really gets you, right? So losing our icons means fewer tourists, and we can joke about how great that could be in Maine, but again, economic risk, a nonpartisan issue. Forest pests are finding the winters up here more hospitable now, and our vast timberlands and outdoor recreation hotspots may soon be witness to some pretty serious forest diebacks, right? That's the one that keeps me up at night. That's the thing that I worry about most, are Maine's forests. But again, economic risk. Right, most of Maine's wealth and population is focused in the coastal areas. We've got rising sea levels and more unpredictable storms hitting the coast. So again, not just economic risk there, also health and safety risks, right? And more heat waves, even in Maine, health risks for the elderly. And those ticks that are moving north are also bringing us a gift, which is more Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases. So not just economic, but health and safety risks there as well. And the list goes on. And unfortunately, it gives new meaning to the Maine motto, Dirigo, I lead, right? Because Maine is on the leading edge right now of climate impacts in the lower 48 of the U.S., I think. And it's putting health, safety, and the economy at risk. So we have a lot at stake here in Maine with what's going on in Washington right now. Now, I have a confession to make, speaking of dirigo. I always thought dirigo, which means I lead, everyone here knows that, I always thought it was referring to just Mainers. You know, we lead, we're leaders. There's a farmer and there's a sailor on the emblem, and they're leaders, and we're, you know, that kind of person. Somehow it totally escaped me that the North Star was at the top of the emblem, and Polaris, the symbol of guidance and direction, is sitting there. I don't know how I missed that. The Norse or Viking mariners called it the Lodestar. The ancient European medieval mariners called it Stella Maris. The Arab mariners called it Al-Judeh, all these names for Polaris, the North Star. Even Shakespeare wrote about it in Julius Caesar. He described it as the one and all doth hold his place. So if you'll pardon the pun, Polaris has just a stellar reputation for reliability. We always know where it's going to be. But the North Star is also an important symbol for the Inuit people of the Arctic. It's an important symbol and guide. In Inuktitut, the language of northeastern Canada, it's called Nuksuituk, which symbolizes the wisdom and leadership of their elders, right? And so what I'm going to do in this talk, I've talked a little bit about Maine, but I'm going to talk about some Arctic communities that are dealing with these impacts right now before I get to the third section, which is to prevent you from becoming immensely depressed. I'm going to talk a little bit about what some folks are doing to address some of these things that are happening right now in the Trump administration. So up there in the north, you've got the North Star. It's pretty much the last thing up there that is a constant right now. It's very reliable, as we talked about, but everything else, this symbol of wisdom and leadership and guidance sits up there while the rest of the Arctic is going through an incredibly dramatic transformation. And this was avoidable, by the way. And this is something that is creating immense difficulties for the people that live in or otherwise depend upon the Arctic. We think we have it bad in Maine, and we do. And some of the things that are happening in Maine are results of the dramatic change taking place in the Arctic. But up there, the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. So you can imagine what would be happening if that rate of change were taking place in Maine, right? The sea ice extent is setting record lows every single year, and this year was far more dramatic than most. The warm temperature anomalies. In January of 2016, I remember when scientists and climate scientists and Arctic experts were aghast at how warm it was in the Arctic, and it was called a temperature anomaly. But those big red splotches in the global meteorological maps were dramatic. Well, I don't know at what point an anomaly stops becoming an anomaly, because this year we far exceeded those warm temperatures. In fact, I think the closest recording station to the Arctic is in northern Greenland. And in February, they detected temperatures of over 40 degrees. So the ice was melting at the North Pole in February. Right, there was open water north of Greenland in February, right? So things are changing so fast that scientists don't know how to keep up with it, and they're frankly shocked. It's you don't often see scientists aghast, but that's what's happening there. And for certain commercial interests, of course, this isn't a bad thing. There are some opportunities there. Maine actually might get in on some of that. I know there's a lot of interest in Maine in the Arctic Council and some Arctic opportunities. That's great, but for those Alaska Native communities that live up there, this presents an existential threat. Each village in the Arctic is a unique culture with unique traditions and practices and a distinct dialect and a relationship with time and solitude and climate that is uniquely their own, right? So I don't think it's a stretch to say that every single one of these separate communities in the Arctic punches well above its weight in terms of the contribution to global cultural diversity. And this is true of the Inuit of Russia, the U.S., and Canada and Greenland, the Aleut of Alaska, the Gwich'in and the Athabascans of Alaska and Canada, and the Sami reindeer herders of Europe and Russia, right? They've been doing this for millennia, persisting through some very difficult changes in a very forbidding environment, showing amazing resilience. But they have never seen change this fast, right? No humans have seen on the Arctic changing this quickly. And in that, plus the actions of this resilience of theirs, despite the actions of non-Indigenous actors in the region that have been affecting their ability to bounce back already, now they're on the brink of being wiped off the map up there. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this before I get into what I ran into with the Trump administration. In Alaska in particular, we have villages that are by no fault of their own located in probably the most vulnerable places, some of the most vulnerable places on Earth. These are barrier islands and spits of land that face directly out to the storms coming off the Chukchi Sea, the Bering Sea. And historically, of course, they've been locked in place by the permafrost. And the sea ice comes in and in the early fall and stills the seas. So when the storm season comes in the fall, they're protected. Now, of course, that's no longer the case. The permafrost is melting out from underneath their feet. The sea doesn't, this year I don't think they saw sea ice in Barrow until mid-November or something, well past the time when the storms have come in and chewed away a few more meters of land, right? So they're in a very difficult situation. They need to relocate, and even the federal government about 12 years ago determined that they are in unsafe locations and need to relocate 12 years ago. Now, many of them by now have voted to relocate, but unfortunately, the Trump administration has turned their backs on these folks. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my experience as a whistleblower to give you a sense of what we're up against, both in Maine and in Alaska, with these climate impacts. Give you a little bit of a taste of what they're up to in this administration.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Joel Clement is discussing the effects of climate change he found in Alaskan communities and how that led him to resign from his position at the U.S. Department of the Interior.
So for nearly 7 years, I ran the policy office at the Interior Department. I was also the lead climate policy advisor there. And the Interior Department, every aspect of every mission of every bureau and office at Interior is affected by climate impacts, whether it's managing our legendary national parks, protecting biodiversity at the Fish and Wildlife Service, providing that world-class science that the U.S. Geological Survey provides, or managing one-fifth of the American land area, which is what DOI does. Every aspect of what they do is affected by climate change. And so I was very public about this. I spoke very publicly and very frequently about the importance of addressing these impacts. I wasn't talking about CO2 and methane. I was talking about how do we handle the impacts that we know are already coming, right? So building resilience and climate change adaptation. And of course, I in particular was focused on these Alaska Native villages. And what they're up against up there, right? I should mention that DOI Interior is also the federal trustee for American Indians and Alaska Natives, so it should be core to the DOI mission to be looking out for the well-being of these folks. Even after the November election in 2016, once everybody sobered up, I was just saying, you know, that there's really no reason why we wouldn't continue doing this work. A lot of folks around the world were asking if the U.S. was going to still emphasize adaptation and resilience, at least. And I said, of course, these are impacts that are happening right now, and they directly affect the health and safety of Americans. There's no way that the government can walk back on that. Now, obviously, I was horribly wrong. I had vastly underestimated or overestimated the integrity and the maturity of the incoming politicals of this administration, right? What happened next was this all-out assault on anything that was even connected to climate change in any way or anything that was connected to the previous administration in any way. And it was like being led by a gang of vindictive fifth graders. And when I first started talking about this after my whistleblower action, I started at eighth grade, but I felt like I was really not giving those eighth graders credit. I've just been dialing it back. I'm now at fifth grade, but a couple weeks ago it was announced by someone that done a study that President Trump speaks at a fourth grade level. So I'm going to, I don't know, maybe I'll stop there, but it's hard to know at what level you stop these days. It just keeps building. At any rate, their goal was to eliminate all the programs from the previous administration. Anything that had the Obama stamp on it had to go, good or bad, effective or non-effective. Marginalize the scientists and experts, get them out of the way, and then shrink and hobble government to allow industry fuller access. It's very clear that those are the three things that they're focused on doing. We're seeing the pattern over and over, all these ham-fisted punches at the rules and the laws and the regulations and the policies that are in place to protect our health and safety and to protect American resources, right? They're going after it. And the only saving grace, actually, is they're just not very good at it. And they keep winding up in court, and they're going to keep winding up in court, and that's good. But some of those punches are landing, and there is some damage being done. One of them was aimed at the senior executive service at the Department of the Interior, where I worked. The SCS, that's the executive corps of career professionals. We're meant to be deployed wherever an agency needs high-level but non-political talent. It's important to have that divide between the politicals and the career servants in the U.S. government. At DOI, there are about 250 or 220 of us, I think, out of 70,000 employees there at Interior. And every administration, when they come in, they move a few of these folks around for various reasons. But no agency in any administration has ever come in and moved dozens around in one night, as this group did, with the apparent intent to dislodge us entirely from the civil service. And to accomplish that, they move people into positions that were completely unrelated to their background or expertise. They move them across the country. There was no prior consultation. They were given no choice in the matter. Many of these folks had families. Most were retirement age, actually. And we just got the list a few weeks ago, finally, of who was reassigned that night. And it's clear now that a disproportionate number of them were American Indians. So there's even discrimination. So, you know, for starters, this was just horrible workplace management, right? I mean, they were checking all the boxes, right down to discrimination, to get it wrong. But then the next week, Secretary Ryan Zinke, who was at the time the only Senate-confirmed employee at DOI, so this was done with a very thin staff, he went up on the Hill to testify, and he said that, yes, indeed, he would be using reassignments as one means to trim the DOI workforce by about 4,000 people. And, of course, if you think about it for a second, a reassignment doesn't exactly trim the workforce unless you get those people to quit. And while you can move SES people around willy-nilly, even involuntarily, you can't do that with the intent to get them to quit. So the secretary was essentially up on the Hill admitting his unlawful strategy to Congress, which is pretty remarkable. At any rate, I guess it was obvious that I was on their list. I believe because of my work on behalf of Alaska Natives facing these climate change impacts. And they seemed particularly eager for me to quit. And I say that because I was the climate change guy, right? They moved me to the office that collects and disperses royalty income from the oil and gas and mining companies, right? So, and we just found out Monday, actually, we got some more documents from a FOIA request. They intended to do that and send me to Tulsa, Oklahoma. So they were really going for it. Like, there was no question they wanted me out of there. And I really liked the people in the office I was reassigned to, in the auditing office. They're wonderful people. They bent over backwards. They tried to accommodate me and teach me how to be an executive in an auditing office and all these things. But, of course, in the end, it's a huge waste of my expertise and background and my salary. It was just very poor governance. But more importantly, it ended my work supporting the Alaska Natives. There is, in fact, to this day still, there is no one in D.C. coordinating the federal response to this slow-moving disaster in Alaska. Nobody is doing that in D.C. And for these communities, this is not a policy debate, right? They're wondering what the hell's going on back in D.C. because they're seeing not just their livelihoods, but their homes threatened daily, particularly in the fall when we all cross our fingers that big storm's not going to come and take them right off the map. So I found a great employment attorney in D.C., and I filed a whistleblower complaint with the Office of Special Counsel, where you send those kinds of things. And I took the unusual step of going public with it as well, with an op-ed in the Washington Post, as Peggy mentioned. And as some of you saw, and Peggy described it as a firestorm, certainly I had a lot of learning to do. I did not realize what would happen at that point. But the reaction was intense and interesting. I think a lot of people really wanted to see someone raise their hand and say, okay, hold on, there's something wrong going on here. It wasn't just the public response and the media response, but in the Senate, they were pretty ticked off. Eight senators wrote a letter to the Inspector General at DOI saying, all right, you need to look into this. This does not smell right. And that investigation is ongoing now. A group of America's top legal scholars, I didn't know this at the time, but they were, in fact, the top legal scholars in the country, wrote a letter to the Office of Special Counsel on my behalf saying, hey, you know, this is dangerously close to politicizing the civil service. Pay attention to this case. And the response from my federal colleagues was very humbling, you know, because I'm getting anonymous letters still from around the country saying, thanks for giving us a voice, because so far we don't quite have the courage to do this. But the coolest thing was that some guy wrote a play, partly inspired by my op-ed in the Washington Post. It's called The Bees Are Watching, and I'd love to be able to see it. So the reaction was fascinating. And anyway, as my dad said, you caused quite a stir. And I did. Yeah. It's good that dad gets the longest applause from that. But, you know, I always quote from Walt Disney's brother Roy, who said that when values are clear, decision-making is easy. And this was a no-brainer for me. They'd already taken my job, right? All I had left was my voice, and I needed people to know what was happening in this administration. So it wasn't such a lift for me. A couple months later, when I chose to resign, I took the opportunity again to tell folks what Secretary Zinke and his team were up to. And you can read about that in the Washington Post, too. I think they published my resignation letter there. It's just appalling to me that the political leaders in charge of these agencies, they've been put in charge of running these agencies, but they're putting profit over safety. They're trying to take the agencies apart. And it's having a dramatic effect on not just our health and safety, but our economy and our natural resources. I mean, it just... it's putting more of us at risk, and it's just so brazen and thoughtless that it stuns me. And the Alaska Natives, in the Native villages in the Arctic, are a vivid example of the implications of that. But also here in Maine and Mainers, you're next on the list. These are very important impacts, and it's going to affect us all in some interesting ways. Not all horrible. Maybe there are some business opportunities in the Arctic, but a lot of things are going to change. And I should note that the complicated issues surrounding relocation in the Arctic, or managed retreat, or dislocation, which is when, you know, they just say, get out of here now and don't come back because there's nothing to come back to, right? That's the worst case scenario. So that these things are already starting to play out in the lower 48, right? We saw last year with Houston and Puerto Rico. We've seen it with New Orleans before, and it's almost always the poorest among us that suffer the most and are on those front lines of impacts. Don't think for a minute that how we handle the village of Shishmaref in the Arctic doesn't have implications for what happens in Miami Beach and what happens in Boston Harbor, or how we address inundation on the Portland waterfront. I mean, these things are very, very connected to what's happening in the Arctic. So I'm going to try and get a little positive now, because this is just dark stuff. But, you know, what can be done? How can we put science back in the forefront of public policy, make it the North Star of public policy once again? And how can we ensure that profit isn't the first thing that our political leaders are working toward, right? And it should be our health and safety. I talk about five things that we can do or that we can focus on. The first is, I'll just list them, democracy, transparency, fair budgeting, rule of law, and science advocacy. And for starters, democracy is the easy one. Everyone knows we need to vote the suckers out, right? I mean, that's what you got to do when this kind of thing happens, right? But, yeah. That's the first step. And again, I don't blame all the Republicans, right? I mean, the GOP has clearly become a willing host for this parasite, right? And it takes a willing Congress to let this stuff happen. So those are the folks that represent you. So vote accordingly. Vote for people that respect science. Vote for people that respect decency, right? Vote for people that respect Americans, all Americans. You know, it shouldn't be that hard. And by the way, ask hard questions during these campaigns coming up, because there's a lot of lying going on. People are lying a lot. I don't know when that started to be so obvious and so brazen. But, I mean, they can be faced with the truth right before them and say that's not real. Just yesterday, Secretary Zinke was testifying on the Hill, and he said he's a strong believer in science. And that, you know, Senator Hirono, who asked him the question, almost did a spit take. Actually, the entire Twitter sphere did a spit take when he said that, because I was getting all those things. You know, he may think he's a strong believer in science, but he sure as hell doesn't believe scientists, right? Because at every turn, he's trying to undercut their work because it's interfering with his own ambitions to hand over the assets of the federal government to industry, and it's brazen. Anyway, people are lying a lot, so pay attention to that. And run for office, for crying out loud. So democracy, that's an important one. The second one is transparency. We need to be demanding more transparency from this administration. I know it seems like they're going to ignore you, but it's coming around. It's coming for a full circle. They just did set a record for non-transparency. This is the I think they've now failed to produce more requested documents than any administration in history. And they're only a little over a year in. So that's dramatic. But last week, we have been having a lot of success with the Freedom of Information Act inquiries, right? The FOIA. Now, there's a lot of press right now about how long they're taking and how they're ignoring a lot of these requests. But we are starting to get some play. Part of it is because we're suing the agency. I sued the agency months ago because they weren't responding to these FOIA requests. And they have to. And they're finally starting to unload some of these documents and post them on the FOIA website at DOI. And we learned a lot. We learned that Zinke's team has tried to squelch climate change science, that his officials have been meeting exclusively with industry only, that they have treated career employees like cattle, and that Secretary Zinke needed $139,000 doors installed in his office. That was just this week, right? And wasn't too long ago, maybe a week or two ago, where we found out that Secretary Zinke lied when he said that shrinking Bears Ears and Grand Escalante National Monuments was not about giving access to oil and gas interests. We've got the emails now that show that he just flat out lied about that. And we need to insist on this transparency up front. We're getting this after the fact, and they're getting away with it. We need to do more on this. It's also, you know, the websites are getting cleansed of things like, what can you do in a changing climate, right? I mean, this is for farmers and for people that work outdoors, for people that manage towns on the waterfront. You know, this is important information the federal government provides. We need to be able to do that through these websites. They can't censor those. The third thing is fair budgeting. Budget season is here. And the president proposes a budget, which is mostly fantasy. It's very aspirational. It's Congress that writes the budgets, right? Now, they're not as extreme as the White House in most cases right now, but they still have a lot of tricks up their sleeve, and you need to be keeping an eye on those through your congressional representatives because they have ways to shrink the agencies and favor industry as well, right? They represent you. You know, some of those tricks like the poison pill anti-science writers and things like that. Some of you here are working on this stuff and keeping an eye on it and publicizing it, so thank you very much for what you're doing there. There are a lot of other attempts to undercut science and the role of expertise. So on the budgets, they need to focus on fully funding the agencies that use science to protect us. It's that simple. Instead of trying to advance these unpopular, controversial, weird policies that are essentially giveaways to their kind of demagogues, their ideologues, their industry allies, right? So we need to be on top of that. And a lot of folks here are doing that good work, so thank you for that. The fourth one is the rule of law. And I mentioned earlier that it's starting to pay off, right? I mean, I think for the third time, the courts have said to Secretary Zinke, you can't allow venting and flaring of methane. You need to implement that rule. It's a powerful greenhouse gas. Three times he went back and tried again to allow his cronies in industry to disregard methane. The courts have said no. Even that case, the kids, they're suing the federal government, the Giuliana case, Giuliana v. United States, they're getting a hearing. They're getting a hearing in the Ninth Circuit. this is the first climate change hearing. This goes back to like the Scopes monkey trial, right? This is legal history, so it'll be interesting to see what we learn in these hearings. I think the judge is very interested to hear how that case may be advanced. So the fifth thing is science advocacy. Some of you may know I'm a senior fellow, part-time senior fellow with the Union of Concerned Scientists now. They have some really fantastic programs that you can engage with, because these attacks on science are undermining our democratic institutions. They're not just undermining science, right? Science should be that North Star of public policy. So they have a science network. As a scientist, you can be a science watchdog with UCS. They teach you kind of how to call out the lies of the administration and confront them on some of their misleading policies and spotlight these dangers of what they're doing. So it's an important program. So there are some really amazing folks on all five of those things doing some great work. Again, many of them here. You'll hear it from three after I'm done. They're really doing some fantastic work. Now, before I conclude, I want to get back to the Inuit meaning of the North Star, right? Wisdom, leadership, and guidance. That's what it means. It's so striking to me in this kind of northern poetic way, right, that this unchanging beacon is hanging over the Arctic. And for millennia, it's represented those very qualities that are so scarce right now in the public domain. But those are the qualities that hold the key to solving these puzzles, right? And my hope is that during this horrible social churning that's happening in the United States right now and elsewhere, actually, that some form of civic responsibility will emerge to produce those qualities and the abundance necessary to save cultures and to save lives. And I hope that if that does happen, you're part of that emergence. I hope some of you are able to be part of that emergence. And if you are, I look forward to working with you. So thanks very much for listening to what I have to say today. And I'm looking forward to some questions. Okay, thanks.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Joel Clement will now answer questions from the audience. And joining him on stage are Pete Dittesheim, Senior Director of Advocacy at the Natural Resources Council of Maine, Maureen Druin, Executive Director of Maine Conservation Voters, and Sean Mahoney, Executive Vice President and Director of the Conservation Law Foundation in Maine.
Have you got a favorite policy for dealing with climate change? I happen to be with Citizens Climate Lobby, and we have something called carbon fee and dividend. Is that something that you could go for, or do you have some other policy that you would rather see or to modify?
You know, what I always say, because this is not my area, right? I'm not the mitigation guy, and there are a lot of really interesting economic and legal ideas out there, from cap and trade to the dividend ideas. I don't actually care about trade. I don't care where the dividend goes. There needs to be a cap. The key is that there be a cap, that we have to stop producing the emissions. So if there's a policy out there that does that, then that's what matters, right? I know there's going to be political wrangling over where the money goes if there's a tax or any other kind of revenue-generating piece. That's not my bailiwick, as long as it does the job. And some of these are going to do the job better than others. So I'm just going to admit that I don't know enough about it. I'm guessing one of these guys here has a better sense of that.
So a carbon fee is definitely one of the tools that we think we need to implement in order to price the impact of carbon. I think Joel's right, where you set that fee and how you use that fee is a matter of kind of getting more into the weeds. Getting to a point where there is enough support for that is going to be difficult. Out on the West Coast, Washington is pretty far along on that. Governor Jay Inslee has really taken leadership on that. Vermont, our office in Vermont is working on it. So I think it's one of those things that needs to be, you need to ask the folks running for the seat in the second CD here what their position is on it, and hold them accountable to it.
Thanks. Okay, next question. I will just add to that to say that market-based solutions are not going to be enough. We need to do all of the above, but important issue.
Okay. Market-based solutions. I think you mentioned Dow, Monsanto, Exxon. Those, yes, they're in for the profit, but they're also looking into the future. Do you sense that those corporations, along with the military, for instance, are seeing the adverse consequences of climate change and thinking that, gee, maybe 20 years from now these policies aren't going to do them any good?
You know, it's been interesting at DOI, certainly DOD, by the way, they're all over this. They get it. The defense establishment totally understands climate change and what they need to do, partly because Navy bases are on the coast. But it's interesting, all these actions that are taking place at Interior, these handouts to oil and gas industry, in some cases, the industry's not even asking for those. They want certainty. Industry is looking for certainty. They just want to know what the rules are. They don't need to know what some of these policies are going to be. So they're actually concerned that we're seeing this surge of industry-friendly policies right now that are likely to be reversed in the near future. So they're not asking for a lot of these leases on public lands and so on. They're not necessarily asking to reverse all the measures of the Obama administration. So you're right. They see the writing on the wall. Even though we cannot let companies like Exxon off the hook for their many decades of misinformation, we can understand that if they're thinking ahead as an industry, I know that they've done Shell Oil invented scenario planning, right? I mean, these companies know what they're doing looking ahead. Did you guys want to chime in at all on that?
We're actually suing Exxon for, but in part because for their past actions, right? So they, as many of you know, were the principal funders of the disinformation campaign on climate. Before the Koch brothers were around, it was Exxon. It was the petroleum industry. And we're reaping the results of that, we collectively. And so they have facilities, their oil storage facilities are all located on the coasts. They've known since the mid-70s that climate change is leading to increased sea levels and, more importantly, increased storm surges and extreme weather events. And these terminals are all located in pretty poor communities, Chelsea, Revere, East Providence, Baton Rouge, New Orleans. I mean, you go down the list, Houston, New York. So they need to be held accountable. It's good to see a company like Royal Shell looking forward, but they're the exception rather than the rule right now. And I think they're welcome to come in from the cold, but it's going to take some time.
So my question is basically this, and I think the answer is probably obvious, but what is driving the ideological zeal to want to unravel clean water efforts, clean air efforts, issues with climate change? What's driving this at the very basic level? Because, yeah. because really, when you step back, rational people would have to say, that doesn't make any sense. What's doing it?
That's why I say profit over safety is the motive, right? I mean, it's as simple as that, I think. You know, in some cases with these government officials, though, they're not profiting, but they get a lot of access and a lot of campaign dollars from these companies. So they've even got a money motive as well. In some cases, like Secretary Zinke, who has betrayed sort of a lot of ignorance and arrogance in the public arena, right? He clearly has some ambition. He thinks he's going to be vice president or something down the road. So he's wanting to cultivate these high donors. And some of these donors, like the Koch brothers and others who have very deep pockets, once they get behind you, your ticket is punched, you're good to go. So for the politicians, it's satisfying these high-dollar donors. For the companies that do want these policy changes, they want to obviously increase their asset base. I mean, there are other maybe less cynical ways to present it. But
for those who haven't read the book Dark Money, I encourage you to do it. It's about the fossil fuel industry and Koch brothers' systematic capture of the U.S. Congress, members of Congress, majority of the Republican Party, and to set up institutes at 300 or 400 colleges and universities, and to capture the judiciary. And they have financial ties to high-level people that populate most of the Trump administration. And they are their financial bottom line is almost entirely fossil fuels. And so the fossil, I believe our government has become increasingly captive to the fossil fuel sector. And it is, and it explains, I mean, I think the denialism, the denial industry that Exxon fueled for so many years is now just the orthodoxy of those who are attached financially to the fossil fuel sector. And so money in politics has a corrosive influence, and we have never seen it at this scale. I think Citizens United opened it up, but there's now billionaires who are controlling our government at a level that's appalling and undermining democracy.
I agree with all of that, but I would also add that there are some people who are anti-government and anti-government regulation, and that's their political ideology. And I think that's another piece of it. Another good book is Strangers in Their Own Land, which is about Louisiana. And it goes over some of the reasons why people are against government regulation. So I think that's a part of it, too.
Yeah, I will just amplify that to say that book, Dark Money, I think links those two responses very effectively. It talks about a decades-long effort on, funded by oil and gas. But it's also about taking over the state legislatures and the local county commissions and so on and running. That's why when Maureen says to run for these offices that are at the local level, it's absolutely essential because the goal was, as I understand it, to get enough buy-in from around the country. You only need a certain number of states to get a constitutional convention. They wanted to take a lot of this regulation stuff out of the Constitution and to trim the powers that inhibit those things. So those questions, I think those two responses are very linked.
Note on the hopeful side of things, Maine's a small state, right? And, you know, Maine has been pretty bipartisan when it comes to the environment historically. And even over the last 8 years, as Pete was saying, and as Peggy knows from her service in the legislature and Maureen from all of her work there, there are some great people on both sides of the aisle, great champions on both sides of the aisle. And so I think it's important to remember that, like, these people are your neighbors, or they're your town councilors or whatnot. And part of it is just having good discussions with them so that it doesn't get wound up into the identity politics, and it just talks about what's best for the community and what's best for your families, what's best for your kids. Nobody's going to be upset with clean water, right? Or clean air. Who wants to have asthma? Anybody who's got somebody with asthma in their family knows how terrible that is and what it's like to be in Maine in August. And your kid has to stay inside because of the asthma conditions? That's horrible. And that crosses party lines. So, you know, I do think, as Joel was saying, you know, Maine is, it's dear ago. It is small enough to actually take that lead. It's why Ed Muskie was able to kind of take the lead on the Clean Water and Clean Air Act. He had support from within the state.
Yeah. Okay, got one right here.
Hi, thank you all. My question is that we've seen with a lot of other issues that local and state governments are trying to pass more progressive policy issues, and then the state comes down and creates a way so that it nullifies the local policy that was created in a more progressive city. And I'm just wondering if you've seen that happening on climate issues and what we should be aware of in Maine to either advocate for on the local level or to advocate for on the state level so that we don't see state policy overturning local policies?
That's you guys have good questions, and they're hard. So thank you. I technically live in Washington, D.C. right now, so we're like the poster child for the federal government stomping on everything that happens there. We don't even have, of course, representation. So I'll let someone here maybe answer the question about how state policies trumping local and regional policies on climate change, if you can think of any examples.
So we've seen some proposals, not necessarily on climate issues, but on pesticides and a couple of other areas. Interestingly, here in Maine, we have a very strong home rule state, and municipalities have a lot of authority, and it's difficult for the legislature to supersede policies adopted at the local level. But the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, has been pushing model bills nationwide to shut down municipal initiatives on a broad range of environmental issues, and they have passed in a lot of places. Here they have not gotten a lot of traction.
Yeah, I'll just add, Pete was talking about the moratorium on local municipal ordinances for pesticide, control of pesticides, and that's in the legislature right now. We're trying to kill it. But the other piece, too, is ballot initiatives. So we're seeing ballot initiatives passing statewide and then them going to the legislature and being changed. So I think it's really important that legislators know that when you pass something at the ballot, you mean it. And you don't want them to change it. And that's only going to happen if you contact your state senator and your state representative and say, no, I actually meant what I voted for, and I want you to stand up and represent our vote.
Who would have thought that the lawyer would be the hopeful guy? But, you know, I also think that Joel was talking earlier. He went to the Bonn Climate Conference this past year, which the U.S. did not take part of. And the most impressive pavilion there was the Bloomberg Pavilion, and it featured all the states that had stepped up and said, well, you know, this president is taking us out of the Paris Accords, but we're still in, right? And so part of it is, in thinking about the states, and our state is an exception right now. Hopefully it won't be in a year. But, you know, the states are great laboratories for making change, and particularly where you see Washington, D.C. and Congress being stuck and not really being able to do anything. Last week, the entirety of Congress's work was renaming three postal stations. That's what they did all of last week. So it's not working in D.C., but in the states, you know, there can be some real leadership, and in the cities, right? So Portland, I don't know if Lewiston joined the mayor's climate challenge. It should. You should have a mayor that supports that. You know, cities and states can really be the leaders now where the federal government is stuck.
Well, thanks for the segue then. I might tell us a little story about Bonn. But first, I do want to say there is an example that occurred to me while they were talking, which is in Colorado. It's not necessarily climate change related, but many, I would say, I think there are three communities in Colorado that said, hey, no fracking here, right? It was a citizen ballot, and it was perfectly within their right to say so. Folks here know about hydraulic fracturing. That's how they inject fluids into the ground to break it up, to allow the natural gas to get out so they can extract it. And then they take all the wastewater and they pump that underground, and that stuff is really toxic. And so communities are understandably vexed about that. It's also a huge water waste, right? And water in Colorado is a big deal. So communities said no, and this is a good example of the state coming down and saying, okay, that's nice. Now go back to talking about dog ordinances, right? So we'll see. We ought to pay attention to what's happening in Colorado on those. I'm curious to see how they flesh out. But I will tell the story about Bonn. Thanks, Sean, because it's a little bit of a hopeful thing. So I had been at the Paris conference with Secretary Jewell at the time, part of the delegation to talk about climate change. And, of course, that was a historic conference. They signed the Paris Agreement. Now, for Bonn, I had already resigned. Clearly, the U.S. wasn't going to put me on their delegation. But thankfully, Sweden stepped up, and they put me on theirs and brought me there. Incidentally, Sweden got in deep trouble with the embassy in Stockholm. The U.S. embassy called and said, I hear that you're hosting this guy, Joel Clement, and how would you feel if we hosted a dissident at an event of ours, right? So, you know, in foreign service circles, the term dissident is a very particular term, and it means a lot. So I don't know how they got away with saying that. But the response from the foreign minister in Sweden was, okay, well, you know what? We know all about your First Amendment, so we're just going to call the newspaper and the radio stations, and he's going to do a few extra interviews. That was how they handled it. So shout out to Sweden right there. But the hopeful thing about that, I expected to go to Bonn, and it's the UN Climate Conference, right? And this was the first one where the Trump administration had some legs under him, and we knew what was going to go on with them, that this was going to be a disaster. Right, and that they weren't going to show up, and they were going to be disruptive. And the headlines every day were going to be, the U.S. sucks, right? That's how it seemed to all of us going in. And as Sean mentioned, the fascinating thing was that the headlines were U.S. steps up every day in the papers. And it was remarkable because people like Mike Bloomberg and Jerry Brown and some of the governors, Governor Inslee from Washington State, they got together and they formed this thing called America's Pledge, which, as Sean mentioned, was These are CO2 commitments from states, cities, and corporations around the U.S., and their combined GDP would have made them the third largest country in the world, right? So even though we were duds there on the federal level, at the sub-federal level, the sub-national level, it was a fantastic showing. And the Trump effect was to increase ambition, and not just here in the U.S., but other countries increased their ambitions and their pledges as well because they saw the U.S. dropping the ball. So there is a Trump effect that's positive. For me, I was just tickled because I was trying to get a selfie with Al Gore, and he was over here, and he was mobbed by people, and I couldn't get anywhere near him. But I got him in the background, and I thought that'd be good enough. And then some guy grabs my arm and says, hey, the vice president would like to speak with you. And I was like, no. So, you know, I had a private meeting with Al Gore, and I met with some governors and some mayors, and it just, the energy of this thing was electric. And it was a really, you know, you don't often see at international negotiations, you don't often see this kind of energy. It's really, if you ever have a chance to be part of a delegation, a lot of NGOs go, I would recommend it, because there's a lot of problem solving that happens at this thing. So lest we feel like everything's hopeless, there's a lot of great stuff happening, even at the international level. So I just wanted to make a note of that. Next, right here.
Hi. First of all, thank you so much for coming here. When we talk about climate change and we talk about environmental sustainability, one of the biggest issues that largely remains ignored is the meat industry and how much that affects the climate change and the gases that are being produced. I'm not American, but I know that in America, a lot of meat is produced, and bread, and the multinational corporations that hold that are really rich and really powerful. That's something that generally remains not talked about, also probably because that's an issue that's even more personal, which kind of leads me into the other question, which was, how do you, you know, work with people who do not agree with these things, especially when it comes to changing food habits and stuff like that?
Well, let me take a first crack at this. Here's where I stand on this particular issue, and I think it's a good way to talk about this kind of difficulty. First of all, I eat meat, but I know there are a lot of producers out there that do it the right way, right? Here in Maine, you have some family establishments that are doing, you know, free range, antibiotic free, all the right stuff, right? They're not the problem. And so I don't like to say don't eat meat because I'm afraid that we'd put them out of business. But industrial scale, anything is generally pretty bad. And industrial scale meat production is one of the worst. You and I are not the ones probably to put that message out there, but that family farm that is doing it the right way, I think they're exactly the right messengers to talk about that issue, right? Because they don't just say, this is bad. They say, this is bad and this is good. This is how you can still eat meat and it's good for the economy. And by the way, my bread and butter. So I do think that there's a line you can walk with that kind of thing, but you're absolutely right. The industrial scale meat production is a big problem, and we're going to run into a brick wall on that. Whether their lobbyists are more powerful than the corn lobbyists or whatever, you know, who knows who's going to win that battle? But it's a big problem.
So I think this is the positive side. The coal museum in West Virginia or Virginia is powered by solar.
That's absolutely right. That's a good way to finish.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Joel Clement, former climate scientist at the U.S. Department of the Interior. He recently spoke with Maine conservation voters at Bates College. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always listen to the program by accessing it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock and R.J. Miller. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.